I'm Nicole Zumach, the librarian at the Kilauea District Public Library, and this is the Opiongo Line. I would like to welcome you here tonight, especially those of you in person at our Lions Hall in lovely downtown Kilauea, and those of you out there on the World Wide Web, as we are all about to listen to a show simply entitled Kilauea's Leprechaun History. We had hoped to bring you a slightly different version, but leprechauns being what they are, we had a few mishaps along the way. Still, we're pretty certain we have enough leprechauns left in Bonnechere River Valley to give you your money's worth. Tonight we're here to help kick off our annual Irish Gathering, one of our most cherished cultural events aimed at celebrating our Irish roots alongside our Algonquin, German, Polish, Cashew, Scottish, and the roots of our other founding cultures here in Kilauea, Hegarty, and Richards Township. And what better way to celebrate than to invite back the Opiongo Readers Theatre, who have been with us several times before for this happy kickoff. With us tonight, we have some of the group's most talented vocal performers. Jane Corbett, Rob Filipkowski, and Kristen Marchand. And so, without further ado, it's on with the show. But first things first, it's a show about history. So even if it's leprechaun history, we need to be sure everyone out there understands the history of Kilauea and area. Take it away, Jane.
Kilauea is named after a famous little Irish town nestled along the River Shannon in County Clare. It's very well known throughout Ireland as the birthplace of Brian Boru, that high king and conquering hero who rid Ireland of all those nasty Vikings back in the 11th century. In more recent times, Anthony Trollope used Kilauea in County Clare as the setting for his famous pair of 19th century novels about Phineas Finn. But our Kilauea became just as famous throughout Canada in the middle of the 20th century, after a national weather station was established here, and the name Kilauea was heard daily following radio and TV newscasts. But the real story of the settlement of Kilauea, the one here, not the one in Ireland, began long before the 19th century, as this area had long been occupied by the Algonquin First Nation, who still continue an ongoing land claim which covers the entire region. Indeed, it was because of the local indigenous population that a fur trading post was established on Golden Lake in 1825 and later run by Charlie Thomas. In the 1840s, two lumbermen then showed up in the area, an Irishman by the name of John Brennan, who brought the first raft of timber down what later became known as Brennan's Creek. He was followed by a Scotsman, William MacDonnell, who established a shanty town 2 miles downstream from Brennan and called it Fort MacDonnell, though MacDonnell didn't have his wife and family join him until 1858, when he built a house on what is now Angus Street. Another legendary Irishman arrived later in the 1840s. Paddy Garvey came from County Sligo, and after arriving in Montreal, he apparently walked all the way to Kilauea. He was the father of Martin Garvey, the bard of the Bonnechere, and the author of The History of Kilauea. In 1856, James Bonfield, another Irishman, arrived and set up his logging operation near John Hazelton, who had built a grist mill on Brennan's Creek in 1850. Bonfield had come from Kilauea, County Clare, and so named his new home along Brennan's Creek, Kilauea. Later in the 1860s, most of Fort MacDonnell was suddenly reduced to a pile of ashes after having been burnt to the ground by accident, making way for that later Phoenix Rising, Kilauea Station, which would eventually rise up and replace Fort MacDonnell. By 1870, Polish, Kashub, and German settlers were also arriving in the area and helping to build that new town, having themselves come up the old Opiongo colonization road that passed through nearby Brudenell. Old Killaloe was still centered on Hazleton's grist mill, which continued to operate until 1930, when its water power was converted to running a planing mill. But back in 1894, as the Ottawa, Arnprior, and Parry Sound Railroad passed through what had been the old town site of Fort Macdonell, it finally and officially became Killaloe Station. Eventually, the site near the grist mill became known as Old Killaloe, and Killaloe Station eventually just became simply Killaloe. Killaloe's most recent claim to fame happened in May 2014 when the founders of Beaver Tales, Grant and Pam Hooker, officially named Killaloe as the birthplace of the Beaver Tales, a very popular Canadian donut-like snack food.
Of course, history to some is pure bunkum if you don't include real, honest-to-goodness local history, the history we all know to be true. And so it's always important to remember there's the history you hear about in school, and then there's real, local Killaloe leprechaun history. Take it away, Kristen.
Leprechauns, of course, are well known in our area. If you drive through the little village of Douglas, just a hand's race down the road from here, you'll see a sign welcoming people to Douglas, home of the leprechauns. Nothing strange or bashful about that. Simple, matter of fact, as it should be. And far be it from us to cast aspersions on the wonderful, if occasionally delusional, folks down in Douglas, for Killaloe also has its fair share of delusional people, and we too have our share of those little green men, and we're not talking Martians. But many people don't seem to know how to spot a leprechaun, even when it's not hard to see them or their mischievous works that litter the history of Killaloe. Too often, newcomers to our area get our real leprechauns confused with those silly caricatures on those even sillier breakfast cereal boxes of Lucky Charms, or that horrid slasher movie about a killer leprechaun, or worse, Disney's movie, Darby O'Gill and the Little People. Nothing could be further from the truth. There may also be some highbrow economic geniuses here among us tonight, who are fans of what New York Times columnist Paul Klugman called leprechaun economics, a sort of magical thinking first made famous by the trickle-down economic theories of Ronald Reagan. But it should be remembered that Reagan's family roots, incidentally, are solidly planted in the ancient sod of Old Killaloe. Not our Old Killaloe, the one across the pond. But whether dealing with voodoo economics or silly magical thinking, real leprechauns have nothing to do with the figments of somebody else's Hollywood imagination. Our leprechauns are real. So, we thought tonight we'd help a few of you recognize what everybody in Douglas knows to be true. Leprechauns have been with us for almost 200 years, brought over all through the 19th century in those old steamer trunks belonging to every second Irish immigrant who ever ended up calling the Ottawa Valley their new home. First off, leprechauns are solitary little fellows, anywhere from 3 inches to, believe it or not, 3 feet high. I kid you not. They are almost never likely to be seen in a group, especially not as a family. Most leprechauns are dedicated bachelors, hundreds, sometimes thousands of years old. They are usually little bearded men, and when out and about in the countryside, they tend to favor large oak trees where they often hide when they hear mere mortals approach. Around these parts, they're fond of wearing either red or green square-cut coats richly laid with gold and a cocked hat with buckled shoes. Often, they have red or white breeches buckled at the knees and gray or black stockings, all looking spick and span and strangely contrasted with their old, withered faces. But of course, in different parts of the Ottawa Valley, leprechauns are known to dress sometimes quite differently. In fact, In some places, that old 19th century wardrobe has been updated so that our modern 21st century leprechauns, they say those who live in and around Maynooth, often wear moccasins instead of buckled shoes. And the ones down in Douglas often sport baseball caps, usually supporting Boston or Notre Dame teams, or occasionally St. Mike's in Toronto, but never the Blue Jays. Even leprechauns have standards. And if you ever see a portly little fellow, well-dressed in a red and green plaid suit, he's probably from Barry's Bay or Mount St. Patrick, where we're told the living is easy. They buy their clothes from only the best French and Italian tailoring shops. All leprechauns, of course, love to get into all sorts of mischief, or, as we like to say here in Killaloe, shenanigans, meaning they sometimes hurt you just for a laugh, or maybe just to get a rise out of you. Their pranks are not known to be fatal, but broken bones and wounded pride have often been known to happen. And though a lot of people assume all leprechauns are shoemakers, that's not quite true. Only the ones you sometimes see hanging around Ofelsky's. Many leprechauns work as tailors, some even as harness makers, but most usually are in one way or another connected to leather goods or the rag trades. Just ask any of those who still practice those trades here, or in Douglas, or Maynooth, or even Mount St. Patrick or Barry's Bay. If truth be told, all those folks who practice those trades locally will have to pony up and tell you the truth about who does their real work, especially when they're under the weather. But it's certainly not true that leprechauns have a pot of gold that they keep hidden at the end of a rainbow. What nonsense! Imagine having to dig up that pot and move it every time a rainbow pops up somewhere new after a rainstorm. Everybody in Killaloe, whoever turned over an oak leaf or looked behind an oak tree and spotted a leprechaun, knows they keep their gold hidden in only one place, at home. And unless they have to move it when found out, it's not likely they'll move it to some spot where a rainbow might appear in once in a blue moon. Though to be honest, it does happen every so often. Which is why I suppose the story gets around that pots of gold are at the end of a rainbow. What isn't well known is that leprechauns often carry a purse, and not so much a purse full of gold coins, but because of their diminutive size, a purse that contains, at least of late, a winning Lotto 649 ticket. I kid you not. It's why, if you catch a local leprechaun, you could be in for far more than just any old pot of gold. We're talking millions. Just ask a few of the big Lotto winners around here. If they're honest, they'll tell you a leprechaun had something or other to do with their big win. Don't think, however, that getting hold of one of those leprechaun Lotto 649 tickets is all that easy to accomplish. They are tricky little devils who love to play practical jokes on people who think with their bigger brains that they're smarter, with their bigger feet that they're faster, and with their bigger hands that they're quick enough to catch a leprechaun. Nothing could be further from the truth. That's not just an opinion. It's based on hard, cold fact, as you will see from this story we lifted from a diary from a fellow who used to live in Old Killaloe, near the gristmill on Brennan's Creek.
In the good old days of Old Killaloe, long before bamboo fly rods were even thought of by some city slicker, a local lad by the name of Elias Brennan would go down to the creek that bore his father's name and find a certain stretch of stony, shallow water at night. And with a friend bearing a flaming cedar and birch bark torch, he'd take off his shirt and boots, roll up his breeches, and wade into the creek, groping with his hands under the overhanging stones and sod along the banks, or other harborage where he thought a fat fish might hide. He'd search until he'd find what he was looking for. And in a flash, worthy of a great athlete, he'd suddenly grip a big old brook trout and toss it ashore. I remember when a boy, going down to the creek with Elias, he was an able young fellow, well-boned and willing, a hard-headed hunter, and a marvelous tough wrestler, for he had a backbone like a sea serpent, which gained him the nickname of Twister. More than once, he'd get into the creek with his back to me, stooping over a broad stone, and something would bolt from under the bank on which I stood and dart right through his legs. Elias would then fall with a great splash on his face, but in his falling would jam whatever it was against the stone. "Let go, Twister," I'd shout. "It's an otter. He'll nip a finger off you." "Whisht," he'd sputter as he slid his hand under the roiling water. "May I never read the Bible again if he isn't a leprechaun with a shoulder as thick as a hog." "Grip him by the feet, Twister," I cried. "I will," cried he. But just then, there was a heave, a roll, a splash, a slap like a pistol shot. Down went Elias, and up went the leprechaun, spun like a silver dollar at a pitch and toss, 6 feet into the air. I leaped in just as he came to the water, but my foot caught between two stones, and the more I pulled, the firmer it stuck. The leprechaun fell into a spot shallower than that from which he had leaped. Elias saw his chance and tackled him again, while I, sitting down in the stream as best I might, held up my torch and cried, "Fair play!" As shoulder to shoulder, out and about, up and down, roll and tumble, to it they went, Twister and the leprechaun. Elias never so twisted as ever before, yet through cross buttocks and capsizes innumerable, he still held on. Now hauled through a pool, now hauling up a bank, now heels over head, now head over heels, now head over heels together, now doubled up in a corner, but at last, stretched fairly on his back, and foaming for rage and disappointment, he lay, while the victorious little leprechaun, slapping the stones with its hands and its feet, spray whirling from its shoulders at every roll, went down towards the race at the gristmill. I tugged and strained to no purpose, while the leprechaun ran fast, and with a flash and a snort, he was gone, deep into the night. Elias staggered forward with battered bones and scraped elbows, blowing like a whale and cursing like nothing but himself. He extricated me and we limped home. Neither rose for a week. I had a dislocated ankle and the Twister was troubled with a broken rib. Poor Elias. He had his brain scrambled that night and was worm's meat within 3 months. Yet before he died, he had the satisfaction of feasting on some gold he found in the creek. He said his antagonist must have dropped it. But I thought, if he did, it was not so much to honor the vanquished as to ensure Twister never tickled him again.
Of course, it's one thing to hear about leprechauns of old, but it's another thing to actually see one. Back in the early days of Killaloe, sightings of a real leprechaun were about as common as they are today, probably only a few dozen every year. Yet, even if you're not one of the lucky ones to see a real live leprechaun, say this week at Irish Gathering, don't feel too bad. Sightings are about as common during this time of year as deer during hunting season. It's about the only time you're pretty well certain there's no deer and no leprechauns to be found, despite seeing dozens during the rest of the year. Still, it's not hard to spot the handiwork of leprechauns. They continue to leave their very identifiable fingerprints all over the real history of Killaloe. Listen, for instance, to these next few newspaper stories about Killaloe and see if you can figure out how some mischievous local leprechaun set things awry. Back to you, Jane.
August 8, 1889, the Kingston Whig Standard. Last Monday, there was a prize fight in the village of Killaloe, which ended seriously. George Eno and Michael Connors were the pugilists, and they met in the ring at 6 o'clock. Many spectators were present. The gladiators shook hands and then proceeded to belabor each other, and not according to any known rules. After the first round was concluded, John Connors, brother of one of the pugilists, stooped down to pick up something. Instantly, he was shot in the head by Louis Eno, brother of the other combatant. This broke up the fight in the ring. A doctor was summoned and the wound dressed. Louis Eno was arrested and is now awaiting trial. John Connor said he only picked up a small piece of refuse, but others thought it was a stone. Eno says the revolver was discharged prematurely and shows a shattered finger as evidence. And who do you think was small enough not to be noticed and might have just left that little stone that caused all the trouble? Why, a Killaloe leprechaun, of course. From the January 24th, 1950 edition of the Brantford Expositor, Killaloe is tiny, but in the national news daily. Toronto. Why Killaloe? That's what people ask the Toronto Weather Office when they notice the small backwoods village 85 miles west of Ottawa included in the daily national weather forecasts. One of the most frequent queries put to Dr. T.G. Howe, Superintendent of Public Weather Forecasts, runs like this. How does Killaloe, with a population of only about 150 people, rate a daily reporting when Kids Corners, with more than 1,000, doesn't even get an occasional mention? The old German settlement, pronounced Kill-a-loo, obtained its weather station more or less by accident. About 10 years ago, when TransCanada Airlines was setting up a string of emergency landing strips, Killaloe was chosen, and a weather station was set up at the airfield, a few miles outside the village. 3 years ago, the Weather Division reorganized its forecast regions in Ontario and included the Haliburton region. Casting about for a station to be used as representative of the region, the weathermen selected Killaloe. Local conditions, topography, drainage, and other conditions were found to be just about what was wanted. Hourly readings, given more often in times of changing conditions, seemed just the ticket. And that's how our little Killaloe got into the weather report along with the big guys like Montreal, Winnipeg, and other places. And who in the federal government thought Killaloe was somehow located in Haliburton? Why, only someone who didn't notice that a Killaloe leprechaun fiddled with his map of Ontario. Or how about this newspaper story from a few years later in May 17, 1955, in the Sioux Star? Killaloe, hard to spell. Killaloe is an Ontario village whose name many people know how to pronounce, but few are able to spell. It is a place often heard of, but no one knows about, because it is the only weather station between Ottawa and North Bay, and yet almost every Central Canada radio weather bulletin lists the high and low temperatures and the wind velocity at Killaloe. People throughout Ontario know what the snow, sun, and wind are doing each day at Killaloe, but generally have little idea what, if anything, its 850 inhabitants are doing. Reeve Patrick McCarthy of Killaloe tells this story about the notoriety of his hometown. Once when I was at a convention, I said I was from Killaloe, and everyone laughed. They told me they thought Killaloe was a figment of the weatherman's imagination. And who do you think led the laughter at that meeting with our esteemed Reeve McCarthy? Or worse, who do you think made every Canadian elsewhere think we are just a figment of someone's overactive imagination? I could rest my case, but if you think our Killaloe has a powerful group of leprechauns who are causing all sorts of shenanigans with our beautiful little town of Killaloe, wait till you hear about what used to go on in that other Killaloe across the pond in Ireland. Here's a news story published in the Ottawa Citizen on September 9, 1864. Killaloe sees Shannon parked like Red Sea. A singular phenomenon took place on Sunday, August 31st, at Killaloe on the River Shannon. Early in the morning, a regular hurricane commenced to blow, and after it had continued for some time, the bed of the river at Killaloe, in which there had previously been little water from the drought, became perfectly dry when an immense number of fish of various kinds, including trout, eels, etc., were exposed. A crowd of villagers and country people who came to attend religious duties at once gathered together, and a great slaughter of the Finny tribe was commenced. The whole bed of the river was covered with people. An estimate of the number of fish caught may be formed from the fact that one person, it is said, killed 94. Killaloe here, as well as back there in Ireland, has always been a place where leprechauns run wild, creating all sorts of shenanigans and malarkey. I could rest my case. But for those of you who don't want to believe or somehow can't believe in leprechauns, especially those stories about how those little green men are often connected with treasure, here's a published newspaper article from the 1952 April 2nd edition of the Ottawa Journal. Polish Reds say treasures to be found in Killaloe Greens. Claims by the Polish Embassy in Ottawa that a portion of Polish art treasures brought here early in the Second World War were hidden in Killaloe, 140 miles west of Ottawa, was news to the Department of External Affairs and to Killaloe today. Another part of the treasures, which was stated by the Canadian government to be lost, had been hidden in the parsonage and farm buildings at Killaloe, which fact the Polish government was able to establish only in 1950. External affairs authorities said they had never heard of any Polish treasures being stored in Killaloe or held there for safekeeping. Reverend J.M. Schroeder, parish priest of Killaloe, was surprised and laughed when told by the Ottawa Journal that the Polish embassy had claimed that his parsonage was a hideout for part of the treasures. "That's the first I've ever heard of it," he said. "They must have got Killaloe mixed up with some other place. I've never heard of any treasures being stored anywhere near here." Father Schroeder said that prior to World War II, the Polish ambassador of that time had visited Wilno, a Madawaska Valley settlement in the Killaloe area, where a large proportion of the population is of Polish extraction. He had heard nothing, however, of storage of treasures at Wilno. Killaloe, which is widely known as the site of a federal government weather station, belongs to the constituency of Renfrew South MP Dr. J.J. McCann, the Minister of National Revenue. Dr. McCann was in budget meetings all day and unavailable for comment. His staff stated that he had never mentioned the Polish treasures, and it seemed doubtful if he had heard the rumor that some had been cached in his riding. P. McMenny, officer in charge of the Killaloe Weather Station, said he had never heard of any treasures of any kind hidden at Killaloe. Certainly, he said, there was nothing of that kind in the weather station because he had examined every corner of it. Killaloe is not a large place, and everybody pretty well knows everybody else's business and even what they're thinking, said Mr. McMenny. I don't believe it is possible that there could be anything of that kind hidden here and not be the talk of the countryside. A likely story. No treasure hidden in Killaloe. I hope you noticed how everybody who was quoted tried to blame Wilno or said they'd never heard of any treasure being found around Killaloe. A likely story. That's like saying Delmer Hartwig never won Lotto 649 without the help of the leprechauns.
Of course, that doesn't mean that every mishap or piece of good fortune that befalls people around here is the work of Killaloe leprechauns. Sometimes good luck, like a simple cure from some long-standing ailment, just happens. Take this story from the good old days back of the beyond, over there in Brudenell.
From a Montreal Gazette edition published November 21st, 1895, with the headline, The Gautier Rheumatism Case, Brudenell. Investigation having proved the case of Eli Gautier of sufficient public interest, your correspondent found this gentleman at a leading hotel here. Explaining the object of his call, induced Mr. Gautier to talk of his cure.
Yes, I am Monsieur Gautier. I was suffer very much of rheumatic, very long time in bed. That was over 2 years ago. I could not walk 1 acre. I would drop so weak. Oh, mon Dieu, awake all night. Monsieur Coslow sell to me the Dodd kidney pill and tell me they cure everything. I say, Monsieur Coslow, excuse me, I don't want to be cured of everything. I only want to be cured of rheumatic. I am sick of that. At the same time, I was troubled along with dyspepsia. That is also gone with the rheumatic. I am known by every man from these corners over to Killaloo, 10 miles. Every lady tell to me some cure, sure to try. But it is all no bon. The only cure do me good is Dodd kidney pill. I got appetite so the hotel stare at the plate after empty plate like mad. I have no more pain. I walk straight. I am cured.
And for those of you who wonder what a Frenchman like Monsieur Gautier was doing in a place like Brudenell in 1895, may we remind you of the days when spoken French was all the rage here in Killaloe. Over to you, Kristen.
Well, I happened to get born at the time they cut the corn, quite contagious, to the town of Killaloe, where to take just a game and a French masseur he came to instruct us in the game of parlez-vous. I've one father, that I swear, but he said I had a pair, and he struck me when I said it wasn't true. And the Irish for a joint and the French for half a pint, faith, we learned it all in school at Killaloe. You may talk of Bonaparte, you may talk about Descartes, or any other party and come over parlez-vous. We learned to sing it easy, that song the Marseillaise. Boulogne, Toulon, the Continent, we learned to Killaloe. May we, monsieur, would cry. Well, of course you can, says I. No, no, I know, say I with some surprise. Then a boy straight up from Clare heard his mother called a mare. He gave monsieur a fist between the eyes. Says monsieur with much alarm, go and call for gendarme. There's no such name, says I, around this place. Come on, he made reply. Come on yourself, says I, and I scattered all the features of his face. Oh, boys, there was the fun. You should see him when 'twas done. His eyeballs, one by one, did disappear, and a doctor from the south took some days to find his mouth, which had somehow got concealed behind his ear. Then he swore an awful oath he'd have law against us both, and then he'd lave both Limerick and Clare, and he found it wouldn't do to teach French in Killaloe unless he had a face or two to spare. To the magistrate he went, and a lot of time he spent, says the magistrate, "Begorry, I'm perplexed, for a feller who you see spells whiskey, ODV, you never know what he'll come up with next." Then nothing more was said. Monsieur went home to bed and mixed no more in Killaloe affairs, and the papers of the place of the foreign teacher's face was closed for alterations and repairs. If disguises you would try, or would prove an alibi, or alter your appearance just for fun, you'd just one thing to do, go teach French in Killaloe, and your mother will not know you for her son. French may be very fine, it's no enemy of mine, but I think you'll easily suppose, whatever tongue you take, it is mighty hard to speak, while your ear keeps changing places with your nose. Now I'm glad to find 'tis true ye are pleased with Killaloe, and our conduct to the teacher they did send, but I've told you all that past, so this verse must be the last. That's the reason I left it till the end. We're all Irish tenants here, and we're all prepared to swear that to the Irish language we'll be true. But we always want consent when they ask us for the rent. Sure, we answer them in French in Killaloo.
There are a few local cases where, shall we say, we remain between sixes and sevens, or on the fence, so to speak, about whether or not local leprechauns were, in fact, responsible for local shenanigans. For instance, listen carefully to this next little bit of local verse by, well, we better not say, it's a tad embarrassing for those innocent and guilty parties involved, and we wouldn't want it getting around that our local boys are all as inept as this poor fellow. Let's just say we know who he is, but we've also always wondered if it was a leprechaun who mixed up those boxes you're about to hear about. Over to you, Rob.
I was backward at going forward. And why, I didn't know. Some people said that I was shy, but others called me slow. My father blamed me mother for raising such a dozy sod, while she maintained it was all his fault, that all his folks were odd. Why don't you go out and get a woman? He used to say to me. Sure, when I was your age, I always had two or three. And a wee bit of advice I'll give you now. Remember this, my son. If you're not in bed by 12 o'clock, you'd be far better off at home. Now, I had my eye on Mary Ann these last 8 years or so, but the thing that always held me back was the fear she might say no. You see, me problem was I turned her down back in her younger days. Mind you, it's not she's got better looking, it's just I'm not as hard to please. If I tell you she was ugly, I would not be telling lies. She once worked in a butcher's shop just to keep away the flies. But I was at the stage when it come to looks, I just didn't give a damn. I'm sure you would say it was just as well if you saw the cut of Mary Ann. From time to time, I'd meet her down by McCarthy's shop, but I never had the courage to bring the subject up. You see, she still was cool with me since I turned her down that time. But since she got a bit of land and money, I kind of changed my mind. I was put in contact with a man, an expert in these things, who swore to me he had a plan. Indeed, he told me to buy the ring. Says he, if you will follow my get a woman plan, within a week or two, she'll be eating out of your very hand. Now, the next time you see her, pay her a lot of heed. Look closely at what she's wearing. See if there's something she might need. Perhaps a scarf for around her neck. Something for her hair. If you like the plan, come back to me and we'll take it on from there. Later on that evening, I was out behind the barn with me rake and scythe. I made up my mind to go for it. Sure, God, they say, loves a trier. Sure, after all, I'd be no worse off if the old bag she says no. I just remind her I was right the first time when I told her where to go. Exactly 2 evenings later, I was going in to have a pint. And who do I see but Mary Ann? She's coming, pedaling on a bike. But just when I was meeting her, along comes a great big truck. It nearly blew the clothes clean off her. Did I get a great good look? Now, there wasn't a lot she needed, as far as I could see. Her valuable essentials were all covered to well below her knee. Finally, I spied what a man might buy for the woman he loves. Sure, it was so obvious there in front of me. She wasn't wearing gloves. I went into town the next Thursday, thinking about those hands, hoping to buy a pair of gloves to execute the first part of the plan. I told my ma where I was going and asked if she might recommend a woman's kind. Jesus, she says, wouldn't you be better off to buy a pair for yourself and not always be wearing mine? But after all, she says, I'll go with you. You'll need me to try them on. Now, it wasn't what I planned to do, but I decided to play along. She said, we'll go down to that draper's shop that is owned by Fred McVickers. You know, I'm in an awful way for a pair of pants myself. That's what women now call knickers. So when I went into the shop, I got completely mesmerized. For when the shopman asked me, I didn't know her size. Well, I stood there like an idiot, not knowing what to do. I says, you have me there, but she's about a 7 in a shoe. We bought a pair about her size, as far as I could tell. A lovely pair of leather ones that had a gorgeous smell. I also saw a pair of men's gloves sitting on the shelf. I thought about what Ma had said, so I bought them for myself. The shopman gave me a long list of instructions if the gloves got soiled or wet. He says, can you remember all I told you? And I says, don't you fret. I looked over at my mother. She had her business nearly done. My God, Ma, I says, you better hurry, else our ride will soon be gone. When I got home, I started thinking about all I had to say to Marianne, so I wrote the whole lot down. I knew that I'd be nervous, and I'd forget half of what should be said, so to me it was better to write down everything instead. Later on, I washed and shaved so I'd be looking nice, and I threw on what was left in a bottle of Old Spice. Then I says to Ma, by God, where's the shopping? She says, there, the box is lying on me bed. But sure, instead of taking up the gloves, didn't I take the knickers up instead? I left the house as proud as punch, not realizing what I'd done. I jumped up on the old tractor and got her started on the run. When I arrived at Mary Ann's, I saw she was alone. I parked the old tractor up on the slope and pointed it for home. I kind of slipped up to the front door, and on it I did knock. When Mary Ann opened it up, I said, I'd like to have a talk, and here's a little present for you. I bought in McVicker's shop. I handed her the present with me letter on the top. She started to open up the letter, but I said, Jesus, Mary Ann, you open up the parcel and I will read the letter. The plan was going perfect, so I thought I'd have a smoke. I was as proud as a dog with two cats, not knowing which one to poke. She opened up the parcel. She didn't seem one bit too pleased. A bit of a grin that was there before had quickly disappeared. Oh, God, thinks I, she doesn't like the gloves. I felt an awful dread. Says I, Mary Ann, will I read the letter now? She barked, I can't wait for it, she says, so I start. I wrote to you this letter, my dearest Mary Ann, to explain about the present. I hope you'll understand. You see, the last time I met you, I noticed you hadn't any on, so I bought you these. I hope you're pleased and that they'll keep you warm. Now, why I took this liberty, you're wondering, I suppose. But I could see your skin was turning blue around where it was exposed. And them old flies and midges and that east wind, it can bite. I could see your front was taking the brunt when I met you on the bike. Mary Ann, if you should ever wet them, and you might now, who can tell? You're not supposed to wash them. They'll only lose their lovely smell. And if you should ever soil or dirty them, just wipe them with a rag. But you can blow into them from time to time. They say it helps them not to sag. I don't know if you're superstitious, my dearest Mary Ann, but as for myself, I have to say I'm a very superstitious man. Should you ever drop them, and I really hope you do, they say it's not lucky to pick up your own, so I'll pick them up for you. Now, every time you put them on, I hope you're as cozy as can be, and every time you take them off, I hope you'll think of me. They might be a little tight at first, but that's because they're new. Don't you worry, when I'm with you, I'll pull them off for you. By now, her face was frying. I thought she'd blow a fuse. And the language that came out of her, I never heard a woman use. You old son of a bee and fat arse pee were two of the nicer names she called me. As she swore at me 7 generations and ridiculed me pedigree, it's only then I saw the knickers and realized the mistake I'd made. I tried to explain about the mix-up in the parcels, but this was an unforgivable blunder. With every word that came out of her voice, it rose like thunder. She grabbed Ma's brand new pair of drawers and she flung them in the fire, saying, "Get out of here, you pervert, before I call the law." And with that, she clobbered me with a corkscrew to the jaw. Jesus, I didn't see it coming, and it knocked me off my seat. And in the melee that followed, I lost me cap and two front teeth. I gathered up me things and I made a quick retreat. Abuse was still being hurled at me as I scrambled across the street. She opened up the window and threw out me brand new cap. "Take that rag with you. Likewise, that heinous crap." As I scrambled down the old road, I was knocking off every ditch. And me ears were still a-buzzing from the barks of that old bitch. But I was glad I had escaped and I had survived. I was never as near in all my life to being ate alive. And so I'm sitting here reminiscing. I'd done it for many hours. Just silently regretting, wasn't I the stupid sod for not just giving her a bunch of flowers? When I meet that woman expert, I'll tell him to take his plan and stick it where the sun don't shine, and to hell with Mary Ann.
Time now for a short break, but don't be long. We'll be right back in about 10 minutes with the second half of our show. You know, the part where real shenanigans break out. Thank you.